interstellar travel that are difficult to predict. By one estimate, we will probably not become a Type 3 civilization for 100,000 years, and possibly not for a million years. Transition from Type 0 to Type 1. Of all the transitions, perhaps the most difficult is the transition from Type 0 to Type 1, which we are undergoing at present. This is because a Type 0 civilization is the most uncivilized, both technologically and socially. It has risen only recently from the swamp of sectarianism, dictatorship, and religious strife, etc. It still has all the scars from its brutal past, which was full of inquisitions, persecutions, pogroms, and wars. Our own history books are full of horrid tales of massacres and genocide, much of it driven by superstition, ignorance, hysteria, and hatred. But we are witnessing the birth pangs of a new Type 1 civilization, based on science and prosperity. We see the seeds of this momentous transition germinating every day before our eyes. Already a planetary language is being born. The Internet itself is nothing but a Type 1 phone system. So the Internet is the first Type 1 technology to develop. We are also witnessing the emergence of a planetary culture. In sports, we see the rise of soccer and the Olympics. In music, we see the rise of global stars. In fashion, we see the same high-end stores and brands at all the elite malls. Some fear that this process will threaten local cultures and customs, but in most third-world countries today, the elites are bilingual, fluent in the local language, and also a global European language or Mandarin as well. In the future, people will likely be bicultural, fluent in all the customs of the local culture, but also at ease with the emerging planetary culture. So the richness and diversity of Earth will survive even as this new planetary culture arises. Now that we have classified civilizations in space, we can use this to help calculate the number of advanced civilizations in the galaxy. For example, if we apply the Drake equation to a Type 1 civilization to estimate how plentiful they might be in the galaxy, it would appear they should be quite common. Yet we see no obvious evidence of them. Why? There are several possibilities. Elon Musk has speculated that as civilizations master advanced technology, they develop the power to destroy themselves, and that the biggest threat facing a Type 1 civilization may be a self-inflicted one. For us, there are several challenges as we make the transition from Type 0 to Type 1. Global warming, bioterrorism, and nuclear proliferation, to name a few. The first and most immediate is nuclear proliferation. The bomb is spreading into some of the most unstable regions of the world, such as the Middle East, the Indian subcontinent, and the Korean Peninsula. Even small countries may one day have the ability to develop nuclear weapons. In the past, it took a large nation-state to refine uranium ore into weapons-grade materials. Gigantic gaseous diffusion plants and banks of ultracentrifuges were required. These enrichment facilities were so large, they could easily be seen by satellite. This was beyond the reach of small nations. But blueprints for nuclear weapons have been stolen and then sold to unstable regimes. The cost of ultracentrifuges and purifying uranium into weapons-grade material has fallen. As a result, even nations like North Korea, which is perpetually teetering on the brink of collapse, can amass a small but deadly nuclear arsenal today. Now the danger is that a regional war, between India and Pakistan, say, could escalate to a major war, drawing in the major nuclear powers. Since the United States and Russia each possess about 7,000 nuclear weapons, this threat is significant. There is even a concern that non-state actors or terrorist groups could procure a nuclear bomb. The Pentagon commissioned a report from the Global Business Network think tank that analyzed what might happen if global warming, destroys the economies of many poor nations such as Bangladesh. It concluded that, in a worst-case scenario, nations may use nuclear weapons to protect their borders from being overrun by a flood of millions of desperate, starving refugees. And even if it does not cause a nuclear war, global warming is an existential threat to humanity. Global warming and bioterrorism. Since the end of the last glacial period about 10,000 years ago, the Earth has been gradually warming up. However, over the past half century, the Earth has been heating at an alarming and accelerating rate. We see evidence of this on numerous fronts. Every major glacier on the Earth is receding. The northern polar ice has thinned by an average of 50% over the past 50 years. Large parts of Greenland, which is covered by the world's second largest ice sheet, are thawing out. A section of Antarctica, the size of Delaware, the Larsen Ice Shelf Sea, broke off in 2017, and the stability of the ice sheets and ice shelves is now in question. The last few years have been the hottest ever recorded in human history. The Earth's average temperature has increased by about 1.3 degrees Celsius in the past century. On average, summer is about 1 week longer than it was in the past. We are seeing more and more 100-year events, such as forest fires, floods, droughts, and hurricanes. There is the danger that if this global warming accelerates unabated into the coming decades, it could destabilize the nations of the world, create mass starvation, generate mass migration from the coastal areas, and threaten the world economy and prevent the transition to a Type 1 civilization. There is also the threat of weaponized biogerms that could potentially wipe out 98% of the human population. Throughout world history, the greatest killers have not been wars, but plagues and epidemics. Unfortunately, it is possible that nations have kept secret stockpiles of deadly diseases, such as smallpox, which could be weaponized using biotechnology to create havoc. There is also the danger that someone could create a doomsday weapon by bioengineering some existing disease, Ebola, HIV, avian flu, and making it more lethal or causing it to spread more quickly and easily. Perhaps in the future, if we ever venture to other planets, we may find the ashes of dead civilizations, planets whose atmospheres are highly radioactive, planets that are too hot because of a runaway greenhouse effect, or planets with empty cities because they used advanced biotech weaponry on themselves. So the transition from Type 0 to Type 1 is not guaranteed, and in fact represents the greatest challenge facing an emerging civilization. Energy for Type 1 civilization. A key question is whether a Type 1 civilization can make the transition to energy sources other than fossil fuels. One possibility is to harness uranium nuclear power. But uranium fuel for a conventional nuclear reactor creates large amounts of nuclear waste products, which are radioactive for millions of years. Even today, 50 years into the nuclear age, we still do not have a safe way to store high-level nuclear waste. This material is also quite hot and can create a meltdown, as we have seen in the Chernobyl and Fukushima disasters. An alternative to uranium fission power is fusion power, which, as we heard in Chapter 8, is not ready yet for commercial use. But a Type 1 civilization a century more advanced than ours may have perfected the technology and could use it as an indispensable source of nearly unlimited energy. One advantage of fusion power is that its fuel is hydrogen, which can be extracted from seawater. A fusion plant also cannot suffer a catastrophic meltdown like the ones we saw at Chernobyl and Fukushima. If there is a malfunction in the fusion plant, such as the super hot gas touching the lining of the reactor, the fusion process automatically shuts itself off. This is because the fusion process has to attain the Lawson criterion. It must maintain the proper density and temperature to fuse the hydrogen over a certain period of time. But if the fusion process gets out of control, the Lawson criterion is no longer satisfied, and it stops by itself. Also, a fusion reactor only produces modest amounts of nuclear waste. Because neutrons are created in the process of fusing hydrogen, these neutrons can irradiate the steel of the reactor, making it slightly radioactive. But the amount of waste created in this fashion is only a tiny fraction of that generated by uranium reactors. In addition to fusion power, there are other possible renewable energy sources. One attractive possibility for a Type 1 civilization is to exploit space-based solar energy. Since 60% of the energy of the sun is lost passing through the atmosphere, satellites could harness much more solar energy than collectors on the surface of the Earth. A space-based solar energy system might consist of many huge mirrors orbiting the Earth, collecting sunlight. They would be geostationary, orbiting the Earth at the same rate at which the Earth rotates, so they appear to be in a fixed location in the sky. This energy can then be beamed down to a receiving station on the Earth in the form of microwave radiation, and it would then be distributed through a traditional electrical grid. There are many advantages to space solar energy. It is clean and without waste products. It can generate power 24 hours a day, rather than just during daylight hours. These satellites are almost never in the shadow of the Earth, since their path takes them considerably away from the Earth's orbit. The solar panels have no moving parts, which vastly reduces breakdowns and repair costs. And best of all, space solar power taps into a limitless supply of free energy from the sun. Every scientific panel that has looked into the question of space solar has concluded that the goal is achievable with off-the-shelf technology. But the main problem, like all endeavors involving space travel, is cost. Simple estimates show that this is currently many times more expensive than simply putting solar panels out in your backyard. Space solar energy is beyond the means of a Type Zero civilization like ours, but it may become a natural source of energy for a Type 1 civilization for several reasons. 1. The cost of space travel is dropping, especially because of the introduction of private rocket companies and the invention of reusable rockets. 2. The space elevator may be possible late in this century. 3. Space solar panels can be made of lightweight nanomaterials, keeping weight and costs down. 4. The solar satellites can be assembled in space by robots, eliminating the need for astronauts. It also is generally considered safe, because while microwaves can be harmful, calculations show that most of the energy is confined within the beam, and the energy that escapes outside the beam should fall within accepted environmental standards. Transition to Type 2. Eventually, a Type 1 civilization may exhaust the power available on its home planet and look to exploit the enormous energy found in the sun itself. A Type 2 civilization should be easy to find because they are likely immortal. Nothing known to science can destroy their culture. Meteor or asteroid collisions can be avoided using rocketry. The greenhouse effect can be avoided using hydrogen-based or solar technologies, fuel cells, fusion plants, space solar satellites, etc. If there are any planetary threats, they can even leave their home in large space armadas. They might even be able to move their planet if necessary. Since they have enough energy to deflect asteroids, they can whip them around their planet, causing a small shift in its trajectory. With successive slingshot maneuvers, they could move the orbit of their planet farther from the sun if their star is late in its life cycle and beginning to expand. To supply energy for their civilization, they might, as we mentioned earlier, build a Dyson sphere to harvest most of the energy from the sun itself. One problem with building such gigantic megastructures is there might not be enough building material on the rocky planets to construct them. Since our sun is 109 times bigger than the Earth in diameter, it would require an immense amount of material to build one of these structures. Perhaps the solution to this practical problem is to use nanotechnology. If these megastructures are made of nanomaterials, they might only be a few molecules in thickness, which would vastly decrease the amount of building materials required. The number of space missions needed to create such megastructures is truly monumental. But the key to building them may be to utilize space-based robots and self-organizing materials. For example, if a nanofactory could be built on the moon to make panels for the Dyson sphere, they could be assembled in outer space. Because these robots are self-replicating, an almost unlimited number of them could be built to create this structure. But even if a Type 2 civilization is virtually immortal, it still faces a long-term threat. The second law of thermodynamics. The fact that all their machines will create enough infrared heat radiation to make life impossible on their planet. The second law says that entropy, disorder, chaos, or waste, always increases in a closed system. In this case, every machine, every appliance, every apparatus generates waste in the form of heat. Naively, we can assume that the solution is to build gigantic refrigerators to cool down the planet. These refrigerators do in fact lower the temperature inside them, but if we add everything up, including heat from the motors used by the refrigerators, the average heat of the whole system still increases. For example, on a very hot day, we fan our faces for relief, thinking that this cools us down. Fanning ourselves does cool down our face, giving us temporary relief, but the heat generated by the motion of our muscles, bones, and so on actually produces more net heat. So fanning ourselves gives us immediate psychological relief, but our total body temperature and the temperature of the air around us actually go up. Cooling down a Type 2 civilization. A Type 2 civilization, in order to survive the second law, may necessarily have to disperse its machinery or overheat. As we discussed earlier, one solution would be to move most of the machinery to outer space, so that the mother planet becomes a park. This means that a Type 2 civilization might build all its heat-generating equipment off the planet. Although it consumes the energy output of a star, the waste heat generated is in outer space, and hence dissipates harmlessly. Eventually, the Dyson sphere itself begins to heat up. This means that a Dyson sphere must necessarily emit infrared radiation. Even if we assume that the civilization creates machines to try to conceal this infrared radiation, eventually these machines themselves become hot and radiate in the infrared. Scientists have scanned the heavens, looking for the telltale signs of infrared radiation from a Type 2 civilization, and they have failed to find it. Scientists at Fermilab, outside Chicago, scanned 250,000 stars looking for signatures of a Type 2 civilization, but only found four that were amusing but still questionable. So their results were inconclusive. It is possible that the James Webb Space Telescope, which will go into service late in 2018 and will look specifically for infrared radiation, may have the sensitivity to find the heat signature of all Type 2 civilizations in our sector of the galaxy. So this is a mystery. If Type 2 civilizations are virtually immortal, and they necessarily emit waste infrared radiation, then why haven't we detected them? Perhaps looking for infrared emissions is too narrow. Astronomer Chris Impey of the University of Arizona, commenting on finding a Type 2 civilization, has written, "The premise is that any highly advanced civilization will leave a much larger footprint than we will. Type 2, or later civilizations, may employ technologies that we're tinkering with or can barely imagine. They might orchestrate stellar cataclysms or use propulsion by antimatter. They might manipulate space-time to create wormholes or baby universes and communicate by gravity waves. Or, as David Grinspoon has written, logic tells me that it is reasonable to look for godlike signs of advanced aliens in the sky. And yet, the idea seems ridiculous. It is both logical and absurd. Go figure. One possible way out of this dilemma is to realize that there are two ways to rank a civilization: by its energy consumption, but also by its information consumption. Modern society has expanded in the direction of miniaturization and energy efficiency as it consumes an exploding amount of information. In fact, Carl Sagan proposed a way to rank civilizations by information. In this scenario, a Type A civilization consumes 1 million bits of information. A Type B civilization would consume 10 times that number, or 10 million bits of information, and so on, until we hit Type Z, which can consume an astounding 10 to the 31st bits of information. By this calculation, we are a Type H civilization. The point here is that civilizations may advance on the scale of information consumption while consuming the same amount of energy. Thus, they may not produce a significant amount of infrared radiation. We see an example of this when we visit a science museum. We are amazed at the size of the machines of the Industrial Revolution, with gigantic locomotives and huge steamboats. But we also notice how inefficient they were, generating a large amount of waste heat. Similarly, the gigantic computer banks of the 1950s can be surpassed by an ordinary cell phone today. Modern technology became much more sophisticated, intelligent, and less wasteful of energy. So a Type 2 civilization can consume a vast amount of energy without burning up by distributing their machines in Dyson spheres, on asteroids and nearby planets, or by creating super-efficient miniaturized computer systems. Instead of being consumed by the heat generated by their huge energy usage, their technology may also be super efficient, consuming vast amounts of information and producing relatively little waste heat. Will humanity split apart? There are limitations, however, to how far each civilization will advance in terms of space travel. For example, a Type 1 civilization, as we have heard, is limited by its planetary energy. At best, it will master the art of terraforming a planet like Mars and begin to explore the nearest stars. Robotic probes will begin exploring nearby solar systems, and perhaps the first astronauts will be sent to the nearest star like Proxima Centauri. But its technology and its economy are not sufficiently advanced to begin the systematic colonization of scores of nearby star systems. For a Type 2 civilization, which is centuries to millennia more advanced, colonization of a sector of the Milky Way becomes a real possibility. But even for a Type 2 civilization, eventually they are constrained by the light barrier. If we assume that faster-than-light propulsion is not available to them, it may take many centuries to colonize their sector of the galaxy. But if it takes centuries to go from one star system to another, then eventually the ties to the homeworld become extremely tenuous. Planets will eventually lose contact with other worlds, and new branches of humanity may emerge that can adapt to radically different environments. Colonists may also genetically and cybernetically modify themselves to adapt to strange environments. Eventually, they may not feel any connection to the home planet. This seems to contradict the vision of Asimov in his Foundation series, with a galactic empire emerging 50,000 years from now that has colonized most of the galaxy. Can we reconcile these two very different visions of the future? Is the ultimate fate of human civilization to splinter into smaller entities with only the sketchiest knowledge of one another? This raises the ultimate question. Will we gain the stars but lose our humanity in the process? And what does it mean to be human anyway, if there are so many distinct branches of humanity? This divergence seems to be universal in nature, a common thread that runs through all of evolution, not just humanity. Darwin was the first to see how this occurs through the animal and plant kingdoms when he sketched a prophetic diagram in his notebook. He drew a picture of the branches of a tree, with different arms diverging into smaller branches. In one simple diagram, he drew the tree of life, with all the diversity of nature evolving from a single species. Perhaps this diagram applies not only to life on Earth, but to humanity itself, thousands of years from now, when we become a Type II civilization capable of colonizing the nearby stars. Great Diaspora in the Galaxy. To gain some concrete insight into this problem, we have to reanalyze our own evolution. Looking at the sweep of human history, we can see that roughly 75,000 years ago, a great diaspora took place, with small bands of humans moving away from Africa through the Middle East, creating settlements along the way. Perhaps driven by ecological disasters, such as the Toba eruption and a glaciation period, one of the main branches went through the Middle East and journeyed on to Central Asia. Then this migration split further into several smaller branches about 40,000 years ago. One branch kept on going east and eventually settled in Asia, forming the core of the modern Asian people. The other branch turned around and went into Northern Europe, eventually becoming Caucasians. Yet another branch went southeast and eventually passed through India and into Southeast Asia and then Australia. Today, we see the consequences of this great diaspora. We see a variety of humans of different colors, sizes, shapes, and cultures who have no ancestral memory of their true origins. One can even calculate roughly how divergent the human race is. If we assume that one generation is 20 years long, then at most about 3,500 generations separate any two humans on the planet. But today, tens of thousands of years later, with modern technology, we can begin to recreate all the migration routes of the past and build an ancestral family tree of human migrations over the past 75,000 years. I had a vivid demonstration of this while hosting a BBC TV science special about the nature of time. BBC took some of my DNA and sequenced it. Four of my genes were then carefully compared with the genes of thousands of other individuals around the world, looking for a match. Then, the locations of the people who matched these four genes were identified on a map. The result was rather interesting. It showed a concentration of people scattered through Japan and China who had a match, but then there was a thin trail of dots that tapered off into the distance near the Gobi Desert, through Tibet. So using DNA analysis, it was possible to retrace the route that my ancestors took about 20,000 years ago. How far will we diverge? How far will humanity diverge over thousands of years? Will humanity be recognizable after tens of thousands of years of genetic separation? This question can actually be answered using DNA as a clock. Biologists have noticed that DNA mutates at roughly the same rate across the ages. For example, our closest evolutionary neighbor is the chimpanzee. Analysis of the chimpanzee shows that we differ by approximately 4% of our DNA. Studies of chimpanzee and human fossils indicate that we separated from them about 6 million years ago. This means that our DNA mutated at the rate of 1% over a period of 1.5 million years. This is only an approximate number, but let us see if it can allow us to understand the ancient history of our own DNA. Assume for the moment that this rate of change, 1% change every 1.5 million years, is roughly constant. Now let us analyze the Neanderthal, our closest human-like kin. DNA and fossil analysis of the Neanderthal show that their DNA differs from our DNA by about 0.5%, and that we separated from them roughly 500,000 to a million years ago. So this is in rough agreement with the DNA clock. If we now analyze the human race, we find that any two humans chosen at random can differ in their DNA by 0.1%. Our clock then says that different branches began to diverge about 150,000 years ago, which is in rough agreement with the actual origins of humanity. So given this DNA clock, we can calculate roughly when we diverged from the chimpanzees, the Neanderthals, and also our fellow human beings. The point is that we can use this clock to estimate how far humanity will change in the future if we disperse throughout the galaxy and don't drastically tinker with our DNA. Assume for the moment that we remain a Type II civilization with only sublight speed rockets for 100,000 years. Even if different human settlements lose all contact with other branches of humanity, this means humans will probably only diverge by about 0.1% in our DNA, which is the amount of divergence that we already see today among humans. The conclusion here is that as humanity spreads throughout the galaxy at sublight speed and different branches lose all contact with other branches, we will still be basically human. Even after 100,000 years, when we might reasonably be expected to attain light speed, different human settlements will differ no more than any two humans on the Earth today. This phenomena also applies to the very language that we speak. Archaeologists and linguists have noticed that a startling pattern emerges when they try to trace the origin of language. They find that languages constantly branch out into other smaller dialects due to migrations. Over time, these new dialects become full-fledged languages themselves. If we create a vast tree of all known languages and how they branched off one another and compare it with the ancestral tree detailing ancient migration routes, we find an identical pattern. For example, Iceland, which has been largely isolated from Europe since 874 AD, when the first Norwegian settlements began, can be used as a laboratory to test linguistic and genetic theories. The Icelandic language is closely related to the Norwegian language of the 9th century, with a little bit of Scottish and Irish thrown in the mix. This is probably due to the Vikings taking slaves from Scotland and Ireland. It is then possible to create a DNA clock and a linguistic clock to roughly calculate how much divergence there is over 1,000 years. Even after 1,000 years, one can easily find evidence of ancient migration patterns imprinted in their language. But even if our DNA and language still resemble themselves after thousands of years of separation, what about our culture and our beliefs? Will we be able to understand and identify with these divergent cultures? Common core values. When we look at the great diaspora and the civilizations that it created, we see not only a variety of physical differences in skin color, size, hair, etc., but also a certain core set of characteristics that are remarkably the same across all cultures, even when they lost all contact with one another for thousands of years. We see evidence of this today when we go to the movies. People of different races and cultures who might have diverged from us 75,000 years ago still laugh, cry, and thrill at the same moment in the film. Translators of foreign films notice the commonality of the jokes and humor in the movies, although the languages themselves diverged long ago. This also applies to our sense of aesthetics. If we visit an art museum that has exhibits from ancient civilizations, we see common themes. Regardless of the culture, we find artwork depicting landscape scenes, portraits of the rich and powerful, and images of myths and gods. Although the sense of beauty is difficult to quantify, what is considered beautiful in one culture is often considered beautiful by another totally unrelated culture. For example, no matter which culture we examine, we see similar flowers and floral patterns. Another theme that cuts across the barriers of space and time is our common social values. One core concern is for the welfare of others. This means kindness, generosity, friendship, thoughtfulness. Various forms of the Golden Rule are found in numerous civilizations. Many of the religions of the world, at the most fundamental level, stress the same concepts, such as charity and sympathy for the poor and unfortunate. The other core characteristic is focused not inward, but outward. This includes curiosity, innovation, creativity, and the urge to explore and discover. All the cultures of the world have myths and legends about great explorers and pathfinders. Thus, the caveman principle recognizes that our core personalities have not changed much in 200,000 years. So even as we spread out among the stars, we will most likely retain our values and personal characteristics. Furthermore, psychologists have noted that there might be an image of what is attractive that is encoded in our brain. If we take photographs of hundreds of different people at random, and then, using computers, superimpose these pictures on top of one another, we see a composite, average image that emerges. Surprisingly, this image is considered by many to be attractive. If true, this implies that there is an average image that might be hardwired in our brains that determines what we consider to be attractive. What we consider to be beautiful in a person's face is actually the norm, not the exception. But what happens when we finally attain type 3 status and have the capability of faster-than-light travel? Will we spread the values and aesthetics of our world across the galaxy? Transition to type 3. Eventually, a type 2 civilization may exhaust the power of not just its home star, but all the nearby stars and gradually start the journey to become a type 3 civilization, which is galactic. Not only can a Type 3 civilization harvest the energy from billions of stars, it can also harness the energy of black holes, like the supermassive one located at the center of the Milky Way galaxy, which weighs as much as 2 million suns. If a starship travels in the direction of our galactic nuclei, we find a vast collection of dense stars and dust clouds that would be an ideal source of energy for a Type 3 civilization. To communicate across the galaxy, such an advanced civilization may use gravity waves, which were first predicted by Einstein in 1916, but finally detected by physicists in 2016. Unlike laser beams, which might be absorbed, scattered, and diffused as they travel, gravity waves would be able to spread across the stars and galaxy and therefore may be more reliable over great distances. It is unclear at this point whether faster-than-light travel is feasible, so we need to consider for the moment the possibility that it is not. If only sub-light spacecraft are possible, then a Type 3 civilization may decide to explore the billions of worlds in their galactic backyard by sending self-replicating probes that travel at sub-light speeds to the stars. The idea is to place these robots on a distant moon. Moons make an ideal choice because their environments are more stable, without erosion, and they are easy to land on and leave from because of their low gravity. With solar collectors to supply energy, a lunar probe can scan the solar system and radio back useful information indefinitely. Once it has landed, the probe will create a factory from the lunar material in order to manufacture 1,000 copies of itself. Each clone in the second generation then blasts off to colonize other distant moons. So, starting with one robot, we then have 1,000. If each of them creates another 1,000 robots, then we have 1,000,000, then 1 billion, then 1 trillion. In just a few generations, we can have an expanding sphere containing quadrillions of these devices, which scientists call von Neumann machines. This, in fact, is the plot of the movie 2001, which even today portrays perhaps the most realistic encounter with an alien intelligence. In that movie, aliens put a von Neumann machine, the monolith, on the moon, which sends signals to a relay station based on Jupiter in order to monitor and even influence the evolution of humanity. So our first encounter may not be with a bug-eyed monster, but with a small self-replicating probe. This could be quite small, miniaturized by nanotechnology, perhaps so small that you would not even notice it. Conceivably, in your backyard or on the moon, there is evidence of a past visitation that is nearly invisible. In fact, Professor Paul Davies has made a proposal. He wrote an article advocating going back to the moon in order to search for anomalous energy signatures or radio transmissions. If a von Neumann probe landed on the moon millions of years ago, it would likely use sunlight for its power, so it could continually broadcast radio emissions. And since the moon has no erosion, chances are it will be in near perfect working condition and may still be in operation. Since there is renewed interest in going back to the moon and then on to Mars, this would give scientists an excellent opportunity to see if any evidence exists for the presence of previous visitations. Some people, like Eric von Däniken, have claimed that alien ships already landed centuries ago and that these alien astronauts are depicted in the artwork of ancient civilizations. They claim that the elaborate headdresses and costumes, often found in ancient paintings and monuments, are actually depictions of ancient astronauts, with their helmets, fuel tanks, pressure suits, etc. While this idea cannot be dismissed, it is very difficult to prove. Ancient paintings are not enough. We need positive, tangible proof of previous visitations. For example, if there were alien spaceports, there must be debris and waste left over in the form of wires, chips, tools, electronics, garbage, and machinery. One alien chip would settle this entire debate. So if one of your acquaintances claims to have been abducted by aliens from space, tell him or her to steal something from the ship the next time it happens. So even if light speed cannot be broken, a Type 3 civilization could have trillions upon trillions of probes spread across the entire galaxy within a few 100,000 years, all sending back useful information. Von Neumann machines may be the most efficient way for a Type 3 civilization to obtain information concerning the state of the galaxy. But there is yet another way to explore the galaxy more directly, and this is through something I call laser porting. Laser porting to the stars. One of the dreams of science fiction writers is to be able to explore the universe as pure energy beings. Perhaps one day, far in the future, we might be able to shed our material existence and roam the cosmos, riding on a beam of light. We would be able to travel to distant stars at the fastest possible velocity. When we are free of material constraints, we would be able to ride alongside comets, skim the surface of erupting volcanoes, fly past the rings of Saturn, and visit destinations on the other side of the galaxy. Instead of being a flight of fantasy, this dream may actually be rooted in solid science. In Chapter 10, we analyzed the Human Connectome Project, the ambitious effort to map the entire brain. Perhaps late in this century, or early in the next, we will have the complete map, which in principle will contain all our memories, sensations, feelings, even our personality. Then the connectome might be placed on a laser beam and sent into outer space. All the information necessary to create a digital copy of your mind can travel across the heavens. In 1 second, your connectome could be sent to the moon. Within minutes, it could reach Mars. Within hours, it could reach the gas giants. And within 4 years, you could visit Proxima Centauri. Within 100,000 years, you could reach the ends of the Milky Way galaxy. Once it arrives on a distant planet, the information on the laser beam would be downloaded into a mainframe computer. Then your connectome could control a robotic avatar. Its body is so sturdy that it can survive even if the atmosphere is poisonous, the temperature is freezing or hellish, or the gravity strong or weak. So although all your neural patterns are contained inside the mainframe computer, you have all the sensations coming from the avatar. For all intents and purposes, you are inhabiting it. The advantage of this approach is that there is no need for messy, expensive booster rockets or space stations. You never face the problem of weightlessness, asteroid collisions, radiation, accidents, and boredom because you are transmitted as pure information. And at the speed of light, you have taken the fastest possible journey to the stars. From your point of view, the trip is instantaneous. All you remember is entering the laboratory and then instantly arriving at your destination. This is because time effectively stops while riding on the light beam. Your consciousness is frozen as you move at the speed of light, so you travel across the cosmos without any time delay. This is quite different from suspended animation, since when traveling at the speed of light, as I mentioned, time effectively stops. And while you would not see the sights while you were in transit, you could stop at any relay station and observe your surroundings. I call this laser porting, and it is perhaps the most convenient and rapid way to reach the stars. A Type 1 civilization a century from now may be able to conduct the first laser porting experiments. But for Type 2 and 3 civilizations, laser porting may be the preferred method of transportation across the galaxy, because they will most likely have already colonized distant planets with self-replicating robots. Perhaps a Type 3 civilization would have a vast laser-porting superhighway connecting the stars in the Milky Way galaxy with trillions of souls in transit at any one time. Although this idea seems to provide the most convenient way to explore the galaxy, to actually create the laser port requires solving several practical problems. Placing your connectome on a laser beam is not a problem, since lasers can, in principle, transport unlimited amounts of information. The main problem is to create a network of relay stations along the way that receive your connectome, amplify it, and send it along to the next station. As we mentioned, the Oort cloud extends several light years from a star, so the Oort clouds from different stars can overlap. Thus, stationary comets in the Oort cloud may provide ideal sites for these relay stations. Creating relay stations on Oort cloud comets would be preferable to placing them on a distant moon, since moons orbit around planets and are often obscured by them, while these comets are stationary. As we've heard, these relay stations can only be set up at slower than light speed velocities. One way to solve this problem is to use a system of laser sails, which travel at a significant fraction of the speed of light. Once these laser sails land on an Oort cloud comet, they could use nanotechnology to make copies of themselves and assemble a relay station using the raw materials found on the comet. So although the original relay stations would have to be made at sublight speeds, after that our connectomes could be free to roam at light speed. Laser porting could be used not only for scientific purposes, but also for recreation. We might take a vacation among the stars. We would first map out a sequence of planets, moons, or comets we wish to visit, no matter how hostile or dangerous the environment may be. We might make a checklist of the types of avatars that we wish to inhabit. These avatars do not exist in virtual reality, but are actual robots endowed with superhuman powers. So, on each planet, there is an avatar waiting for us with all the traits and superpowers we desire. When we reach that planet, we assume the identity of that avatar, travel across the planet, and enjoy all the incredible sights. Afterward, we return the robot for the next customer to use. Then we laser port to the next destination. In a single vacation, we may be able to explore several moons, comets, and exoplanets. We never have to worry about accidents or illnesses, since it is just our connectome roaming across the galaxy. So when we gaze into the heavens at night, wondering if anyone is out there, although it may appear to be cold, still, and empty, perhaps the night sky is teeming with trillions of travelers being sent at the speed of light across the heavens. Wormholes and the Planck energy. This, however, leaves open the second possibility, that faster-than-light travel might be possible for a Type 3 civilization. A new law of physics enters into this picture. This is the realm of the Planck energy, the scale at which bizarre new phenomena occur that violate the usual laws of gravity. To understand why the Planck energy is so important, it is essential to realize that at present, all known physical phenomena, from the Big Bang to the motion of subatomic particles, can be explained by two theories: Einstein's general theory of relativity and the quantum theory. Together, they represent the bedrock physical laws governing all matter and energy. The first, general relativity, is the theory of the very big. Relativity explains the Big Bang, the properties of black holes, and the evolution of the expanding universe. The second is the theory of the very small. The quantum theory describes the properties and motion of atomic and subatomic particles that make possible all the electronic miracles in our living room. The problem is that these two theories cannot be united into a single comprehensive one. They are quite dissimilar, based on different assumptions, different mathematics, and different physical pictures. If a unified field theory were possible, the energy at which unification would take place is the Planck energy. This is the point at which Einstein's theory of gravity breaks down completely. It is the energy of the Big Bang and the energy at the center of a black hole. The Planck energy is 10 to the 19th billion electron volts, which is a quadrillion times the energy produced by the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, the most powerful particle accelerator on Earth. At first, it would seem hopeless to probe the Planck energy, since it is so enormous. But a Type 3 civilization, which has more than 10 to the 20th times more energy than a Type 1 civilization, has enough power to do so. So a Type 3 civilization may be able to play with the fabric of space-time and bend it at will. They may reach this incredible energy scale by creating a particle accelerator much bigger than the Large Hadron Collider. The LHC is a circular tube in the shape of a donut 17 miles in circumference, surrounded by huge magnetic fields. When a stream of protons is injected into the LHC, the magnetic fields bend their path into a circle. Then pulses of energy are periodically sent into the donut, causing them to accelerate. There are two beams of protons traveling inside the tube in opposite directions. When they reach maximum velocity, they collide head-on, unleashing the energy of 14 trillion electron volts, the largest burst of energy ever created artificially. This collision is so powerful that some people have worried that perhaps it might open up a black hole that could consume the Earth. This is not a valid concern. In fact, there are naturally occurring subatomic particles that hit the Earth all the time, with energies much larger than 14 trillion electron volts. Mother Nature can hit us with cosmic rays far more powerful than the puny ones created in our labs. Beyond the LHC. The LHC has made many headlines, including the discovery of the elusive Higgs boson, which won the Nobel Prize for two physicists, Peter Higgs and François Englert. One of the main purposes of the LHC was to complete the last piece of the puzzle, called the Standard Model of Particles, which is the most advanced version of the quantum theory and gives us a complete description of the universe at low energies. The Standard Model is sometimes called the theory of almost everything, because it accurately describes the low-energy universe that we see around us. But it cannot be the final theory for several reasons. 1. It makes no mention of gravity. Worse, when we combine the standard model with Einstein's theory of gravity, the hybrid theory blows up, giving us nonsense. Calculations become infinite, meaning that the theory is useless. 2. It has a strange collection of particles that seem quite contrived. It has 36 quarks and antiquarks, a series of Yang-Mills gluons, leptons, electrons and muons, and Higgs bosons. 3. It has 19 or so free parameters, masses and couplings of particles, that have to be put in by hand. These masses and couplings are not determined by the theory. No one knows why they have these numerical values. It's hard to believe that the standard model, with its motley collection of subatomic particles, is nature's final theory. It's like taking scotch tape and wrapping up a platypus, aardvark, and whale and calling it Mother Nature's finest creation, the end product of millions of years of evolution. The next big particle accelerator currently in the planning stage is the International Linear Collider, ILC, consisting of a straight tube approximately 30 miles long in which beams of electrons and anti-electrons will collide. The current plan is that it will be based in the Kitakami Mountains of Japan and is expected to cost roughly $20 billion, of which half will be supplied by the Japanese government. Although the maximum energy of the ILC will be only 1 trillion electron volts, in many ways, it will be superior to the LHC. When smashing protons into each other, the collision is extremely difficult to analyze because the proton has a complicated structure. It contains 3 quarks, held together by particles called gluons. The electron, however, has no known structure. It looks like a point particle. Therefore, when an electron collides with an anti-electron, it is a clean, simple interaction. Even with these advances in physics, our Type Zero civilization cannot directly probe the Planck energy. But this is within the realm of a Type 3 civilization. Building accelerators like the ILC may be a crucial step in being able to one day test how stable space-time is and determine whether we might be able to take shortcuts through it. Accelerator in the asteroid belt. Eventually, an advanced civilization might build a particle accelerator the size of the asteroid belt. A circular beam of protons would be sent around the belt, guided by gigantic magnets. On Earth, particles are sent inside a large circular tube containing a vacuum. But since the vacuum of outer space is better than any vacuum on the Earth, this accelerator does not need a tube at all. All it needs is a series of gigantic magnetic stations placed strategically around the belt, making a circular path for the proton beam. It is somewhat like a relay race. Each time the protons go past a station, a surge of electrical energy powers the magnets, which kick the proton beam so that it moves to the next station at the correct angle. Each time the proton beam passes by a magnetic station, more energy is pumped into the beam in the form of laser power, until it gradually reaches the Planck energy. Once the accelerator attains this energy, it can focus that energy onto a single point. A wormhole should open up there. It would then be injected with enough negative energy to stabilize it so it doesn't collapse. What might a trip through the wormhole look like? No one knows, but an educated guess was made by the physicist Kip Thorne of Caltech when he helped to advise the directors of the film Interstellar. Thorne used a computer program to trace the paths of light beams as they went past one, so that you could get a visual feeling for what this trip might look like. Unlike the usual cinematic representations, this was the most rigorous attempt yet to visualize this journey on film. In the movie, as you approach a black hole, you see a gigantic black sphere called the event horizon. As you go through the event horizon, you pass the point of no return. Inside the black sphere lies the black hole itself, a tiny point of incredible density and gravity. In addition to building gigantic particle accelerators, there are a few other ways that physicists have considered exploring